Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy any investment based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Hello and welcome to the Sunday Roast. It's Sunday the 26th of January. I'm Phil Carroll.
And January's disappeared, and I'm Kevin Horsby.
It is, and end of January, exactly, busy times. We've had the Blue Monday. You know, do you know the Blue Monday? Do you know why it's called Blue Monday?
Yeah, it probably should be called Red or Black Monday, because people are in the red or black, no? Because they're getting their pay from for the last year.
Pay time. I mean, it was actually a marketing gimmick by a UK travel company, but obviously they sort of later caught the public's imagination on a sort of global scale. But I mean, I think the reality, as you say, is that, you know, funds are dwindling away. Obviously, New Year's resolutions, I alluded to this last week, you know, have started to fail, feeling the financial pinch as well of the Christmas spending, probably looking at the credit card bills, crying into them. And then also these longer nights, dark nights and, you know, longer days, bad weather. And we've also had Storm Eowyn. Or Eowyn, I don't know even how to pronounce it, 114 miles an hour winds at Maidenhead in Northern Ireland reported. I mean, I know you're living in sunny Cara, so it doesn't affect you at all, and you're probably just buzzing every day, but it's been pretty grim in the last couple of weeks, to be fair, in the UK.
Yeah, it's an interesting one, isn't it? Because it's been so windy, they've had to turn the wind farms off.
Yeah.
And prior to that, it was very still. So everybody should be thinking massed energy is going to be fantastic, because basically those peaking stations are going to be going 24/7 the whole of January.
Yeah, and we've had a lot of colder weather as well, so there's going to be a big demand on it, as we've talked about. But we'll talk more about that and how it fits into the UK energy. But I mean, let's have a look at the biggest news story of the week. I mean, there's not another story. Obviously, Trump, you know, he's been sworn in, as we say, whatever you want to say, inaugurated as the 47th president of the US. I mean, what do you make of firstly, of the fanfare around it? And, you know, we looked on, we saw them in the Central Rotunda. We saw the likes of Elon Musk. We saw Meta CEO Mark Zuckerberg there. We saw Jeff Bezos there, CEO of Amazon. There was also Google CEO. I mean, we're talking some of the wealthiest men on this planet were there. And obviously the likes of, I mean, Farage, I mean, like, you know, that's almost laughable. Boris Johnson was there, Bojo. Liz Truss, was there as well. So what do you make of it, firstly, of the fanfare? I don't know if you watched his inauguration.
I just saw pictures of it and there's been so many memes about Trump saying X, Y, and Z this week. It's been wild.
Executive orders. Have you looked at any of them that he's already signed? I mean, that pen's been busy, hasn't he? He's been giving away the pens. What do you make of some of those orders? What are the standout ones?
The standout ones is the stamping of the border. That was obviously the big thing for the Mexican border. I think also he's basically having been shot at himself now. He's basically saying, I'm releasing all the information for JFK and a few other people as well.
Martin Luther King as well.
So those ones are interesting. The economic ones, he didn't really press the button yet, did he? He didn't sign them. You know, they're like 25% in China, 25% in Canada. And he's basically intonating he's going to do it, but actually hasn't yet.
Yeah, well, the big one on the energy, and this is a really big one. I'm not surprised by it, but it's pretty devastating, really, is the fact that he exited the Paris Climate Accord, declaring the US will not follow global emissions reduction targets. And he joins the likes of, like, Iran, I think Syria and Yemen, in the three countries that are not in the Paris Climate Accord. So, I mean, it's shocking, really. He said he's going to drill, baby, drill. So that's, you know, big things there.
Yeah, and big impacts as well, I think, especially for one of the companies we're representing, which is Guardian Metal Resources, you know, because obviously their assets are all Nevada, US-based. And there is no doubt in my mind that they're going to, you know, pull up the fences, if you like, to get these things into production. So, and we should be getting
that policy is interesting, because it prioritizes the domestic energy and the critical minerals. And I think it's called Unleashing American Energy Executive Order. So absolutely. So there are a few in the energy space. The big one, obviously, as you said, is the immigration overhaul, which is, basically is going to be sending some, I don't know how many million, but there's millions of undocumented immigrants. And there's obviously a suspension in the US refugee resettlement program, reinstating the death penalty for undocumented immigrants who commit capital crimes, the World Health Organization withdrawal again, which is just, I mean, he blamed them for mishandling COVID-19 and demanding unfair payments. Diversity, he said, effectively abolish government-funded diversity, designed to address systemic racial and gender inequalities. He said there's going to be two genders, male, female. TikTok ban review, another big one we talked about last week. He signed an executive order which is going to give TikTok a 75-day extension to comply with a law, which obviously is a sale or ban the platform. They need to find a buyer for that. And the big one, as you just said, is he signed that on Thursday evening, was the declassification of the assassination files, which is, I mean, that's going to be hopefully bring some truth onto that. I mean, it's been hidden, and will it all just say redacted, redacted, redacted? We'll wait and see what that one. Yeah, but that's it really. I mean, that's the big news story. The other one I just want to quickly mention was the who has won an apology and a £10 million payout from the Sun owner for serious intrusion this week.
Oh, Ginger Royal.
Ginger Royal. Would that be Prince Harry?
Yeah, where does that ginger come from in that line? I wonder.
I wonder, yeah.
No
An
comment.
interesting one, isn't it, that? But yeah, I mean, he settled his legal claim against the news group newspaper NGN, the publisher of The Sun, over allegations of unlawful information gathering. The settlement included NGN offering Prince Harry a full and unequivocal apology for the intrusion into his private life by The Sun. And then in other news, the last one was obviously the ceasefire between Israel and Hamas came into effect last week, marking the end of 15 months of conflict. And the agreement was brokered with assistance from the US, Qatar, and Egypt. Under the terms of the ceasefire, Hamas agreed to release 33 hostages over an initial 6-week period, and the first phase saw the release of three Israeli women, including Emily Damari, a British Israeli citizen. The release was part of a deal where Israel was to release 90 Palestinian prisoners in return. So great to see the scenes of Emily Damari, being reunited with her family. She'd lost a couple of fingers in that attack on October the 7th, but it's great to see them all back with their loved ones. And obviously the Palestinian women, 90 of them have been freed as well. So let's move on to our first guest this week. We're joined by Ben Kloop, CEO of Energy Pathways, a UK-based company dedicated to developing low-emission energy solutions, focusing on integrating emerging technologies with existing energy systems to support the UK's clean energy transition and enhance energy security. Welcome back to the podcast, Ben.
Yeah, thank you. Great to be here.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, since you've last been on, we've seen a couple of news releases we should talk about, and then some recent macro issues which need to be thrown into the mix. I mean, firstly, the company received license operatorship approval from the North Sea Transition Authority for Block 110-4A, home to the Marram Energy Storage Hub MESH. This milestone enables the company to advance its field development plan and environmental statement submission, critical steps towards achieving final investment decision on MESH later this year. Just talk us through this news and what it means for MESH, please.
Yeah, sure. So this approval from the government is a great milestone for the company. What in effect it's saying is that Energy Pathways as a company is has the technical capabilities to deliver on the licensed work program and the development of what we're doing. We were very pleased to receive this approval, not least because of the pace at which that approval was granted. So we take that as a very favorable signal of the government's support in what we're doing.
Absolutely, yeah. And then obviously, secondly, there was the contractor appointment where the company appointed PDI to provide the engineering study support for MESH tie-in connection during the pre-FEED phase, following recent selection of Wood PLC as lead engineering partner as EPP works with its contractors to progress MESH through development and commissioning. You emphasise the project's importance in bolstering UK energy storage and security amid volatile global energy markets. So just talk us through this appointment of PDI and exactly that sort of engineering support that they're going to provide and how it will help to move MESH forward.
Yeah, look, PDI, it's another sort of great partnership that we're bringing into the company. They're a highly skilled engineering house that brings some capability to the MESH project with respect to the development of our storage project. So, we're very pleased to have PDI joining us on the project, complementing Wood and the other companies that we're getting. And these are sort of high quality, high-profile houses that I think enhances the credibility of the project and energy pathways.
Welcome back, Ben. A year or so ago, you listed. So, for anybody who doesn't know anything about energy pathways, just give us a little bit of background about your story and energy pathways in I suppose, the very latter part of 2023 and throughout 2024. What has happened? How has the business developed?
Yeah, so we, as you've rightly mentioned, Energy Pathways listed on AIM in December 2023, and with as an energy transition company, and that's the strategy that we sort of took to the market to prosecute. Now we had a sort of a core foundation asset, which was an undeveloped gas field. But really, what we set about doing straight from that to IPO date is working out how we can sort of maximize value for our shareholders in developing an energy transition solution. And so, during the course of 2023, through our studies and engagements and relationships, and understanding the commercial paradigm of the UK energy transition, we essentially framed a large-scale energy infrastructure development project called MESH. And MESH, in short, will be the UK's largest energy storage facility. And what we think is attractive to our shareholders and to the UK is that it's going to be a critical asset in providing energy security to the UK and clean energy to the UK as well. So we see this project as being fully aligned with UK government energy policy and strategy. And because of the timeframes that we think we can work in, we think we can bring this infrastructure project into operation by as early as late 2027, and therefore have a meaningful impact on the UK's energy transition and the apparent energy challenges that the country is going through at the moment.
So that scenario, when you first came to market, you were a marine gas play, basically. You were going to take this gas out and sell the gas. Over 2024, what I've seen has developed is that now, and I suppose this last month has really verified this, that the wind hasn't blown. And if the wind hasn't blown, then the UK doesn't have any storage facilities for hydrogen or gas or for whatever purpose it is. So that's all really developed so that this is a much bigger project than when you first came to market. Is that fair or not?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. So a pure gas development project, we were looking at a project with a life of six odd years of gas production. We've now converted this to something far bigger, such that we have an asset with a life of 25 years, with robust revenue streams over its entire life, and with the potential to generate returns on capital, very high rates for an infrastructure asset. So, and I think it's circa 20% type rate of return plus.
So when did that light bulb come on then? You obviously came to market with the gas project, and then it's real you've realized over that time that, hey, this is storage is where the future is, as well as obviously taking the gas out, which is going to be very profitable, I presume. But yeah, when did the light bulb go on?
Well, I think it's really seeing how the UK government energy policy has continued to evolve, and we increasingly saw that that storage had a critical part to play. And with the change in government recently, we really see it as much the same as the previous government, maybe faster implementation, but fundamentally, the core thing that is going on in the UK is a massive expansion of renewable energy supply in the form of wind power, and that needs storage solutions given the intermittent nature of that power and the constraints in the transmission network and demand levels. So storage is
Just put
critical
that
for
in
the UK's
terms of
future.
why do they need storage with wind? Surely the wind blows, the electric comes out.
Well, the nature of the way the UK is going about expanding the renewable footprint is that the construction of the wind farms or the development of the wind farms is underpinned by financial contracts guaranteed by the government called Contracts for Difference, which essentially says is that if you're capable of producing wind power, then the government will guarantee a payment to the wind farm. Now, the issue is that when the wind is blowing, is that much of that energy sometimes cannot get to the market. So the government via, well, the consumer, in fact, is paying the wind farms not to produce that energy when it can. And that currently that costs the UK consumer circa £2 billion a year. It's set to increase rapidly by 2030 to £10 billion. So you can see
Wow.
just from that, there's a critical need to harness these essential payments that have not generating any energy value whatsoever. And the best or the feasible way of doing this is to create storage solutions.
So that happens the other way as well. So if the wind doesn't blow, the government still has to make the payment and then
No,
still
it's
buy
only
its.
when the wind is blowing and when it can't be taken into the market. Now, but storage is also critical when the wind doesn't blow, because that's when, from a power generation point of view in the UK, the heavy lifting in the power generation market is done by gas. And so when the wind doesn't blow, there needs to be a ready supply of gas to provide energy security, basically, to the UK market. And where does that gas come from? Now, the challenge that is continuing to emerge and is very much in front of the UK is that when the wind doesn't blow, untapped supply of domestic gas production is heavily reducing.
Winter gets.
And we are looking now at the UK with, let's say, the lack of encouragement for investment in the domestic gas supply sector.
That's the understatement of the century. Lack of encouragement.
Lack of encouragement. I just wanted I wanted to touch on that as
Let's
well,
tax you
because
at 150% or something.
but I wanted to touch on that, Ben, because it's important, because obviously Centrica, obviously the operator of the Rough gas storage facility, which is the UK's largest, highlighted that the current gas inventories, and obviously we've had a big run of freezing temperatures, and they're saying that the inventories are like sort of 26% lower than the same period last year, which is obviously leaving the reserves around half full. Now, I'm sure there's some narrative around that's them saying, look, we want to, refurbish or want an investment in this. But just how much does that highlight the critical need for projects like Mesh? Because my understanding is Mesh is going to be as big as, if not bigger than, the Rough gas storage facility.
That's right. Yeah. So, what we've seen this winter is, let's say, really no surprise. And Centrica has sort of pointed it out, which is when the wind doesn't blow and it's cold, the storage capacity of the UK is very limited, and the UK was down to less than a week of energy supply. And so, it's a really a near miss on blackouts in the country. So that's the nature of the beast, and energy security here is solved by having storage capacity, and there is a demand. So there's a questionable demand and questionable need from an energy security point of view, and as you rightly say, Mesh will be, equivalent to, if not larger than the UK's largest storage facility.
So this wind power will be then converted, I presume it can't be converted into gas, obviously, but it will be converted into hydrogen. And the
That's
hydrogen will
right.
then be stored in the storage facilities at Mesh. Who is
That's
then going
right.
to use the hydrogen? And obviously that's going to be sold by the government to offset this what is £2 billion payment and increasing to £10 billion payment. Well, I say the government, it's actually every person in the UK is paying this money. Who's going to use that hydrogen?
Yeah, so you're just making building on what you just said. So what we've got is an energy strategy fundamentally driven by renewable wind expansion, which is intermittent in nature, which is going to struggle to get to market. Hydrogen is the form of storing that energy in the view of the UK government. And so to enable that hydrogen economy, the UK government policy is essentially looking to develop hydrogen storage in order to harness that that energy. So it's a vector for harnessing stored energy. And then once it's produced and stored as hydrogen, then it goes to, as you've rightly described, markets. How does it get used? Now, there's multiple uses. Hydrogen can be used straight for a decarbonized power gen, for example. It can be used in industrial processes for heat. It can be used to generate such things as green methanol, green ammonia, renewable diesel. It's a key building block for all of those decarbonized type products. Now, in the UK, again, all driven by government policy, the area that we are in is one of the primary locations for the development of a hydrogen economy. So that's the northwest of England, around Manchester, Liverpool, and the up the sort of the Lancashire coast, and that's one of the two lead nodes for the development of hydrogen economy, and that's very much underway with the development of the HyNet project, which is a consortium of hydrogen type projects and facilities being developed and creating hydrogen markets. So why do I say all of this? Our hydrogen storage development that we're planning with Mesh is ideally located to provide the stored energy into that hydrogen market in the UK, and what's more, also ideally located to connect to the to wind power generating or wind energy to harness that hydrogen, because we are surrounded by wind farms in where we're located. There's 7 to 8 gigawatts of wind generating capacity essentially sitting right on top of us.
And when the wind does blow, how much does this wind, these windmills, or wind farms produce that they can't put into the grid?
Well, that depends on the level of wind activity that is going on.
Yeah, and I presume also time of the day, but ultimately
Yes.
there is a lot of energy that could be that is currently being wasted.
Indeed. So, and the wastage of wind energy is, we've already described the financial consequences of that already. It's the also the factor is the nature of the UK grid and the transmission of energy, which causes constraints. Now, in my view, we are ideally located to address this because we sit where we are right next to one of the major constraint boundaries in the UK transmission grid. And so our ability to essentially store that energy and bring it in below the grid constraint boundary is a point of advantage in, manufacturing hydrogen
Yeah.
and storing it and bringing it into the market.
So do you envisage then, from a government perspective, then that they're going to be helping you with any grants or capital allowance relief on the natural gas tie-in at first, and then obviously creating the storage? I mean, I presume this is a natural storage. You're going to take the gas out, and then there it is. There's a big hole that you stick the hydrogen.
Yes, it will in brief. Yeah, it's
Okay. No technical awards for
yes,
Kevin
yeah,
here, but
yeah.
it's a big hole that you
That is,
stick
that's
hydrogen
even lower than layman's terms, that one.
in. But look, to your point, the UK government is initiating through DESNZ, a Department of Energy Security and Net Zero, the translation of that, the hydrogen storage allocation round, the first hydrogen storage allocation round. And what that is a mechanism for providing government support and financial support to the development of hydrogen storage projects. And that allocation round, various projects have the opportunity here to make applications for that financial government support. Energy Pathways will be making an application, and those projects will be measured for suitability for financial support based on the attributes against criteria set by government. But look, in brief, a key component here is that the hydrogen can be stored at scale, and that is something that the Mesh project can offer. And it's also to be able to connect hydrogen supply or production to hydrogen markets, and for all the sort of the reasons I've given previously on this discussion, the Mesh project is ideally located to connect supply to hydrogen markets. So,
Yeah, I've been on Crosby Beach in Liverpool, and all you can see is wind farms galore out there when you're on the beaches. So yeah, but you're definitely in the right spot. But that was coming on to my next question then. It's called the Mesh Project at the minute, which obviously stands for Marram. Is this going to be duplicated? So, or is Marram big enough? Because you've got these Knox and Lowry applications also in for other licenses. Is this going to be a Marram's all we need, or is it going to be, hey, we've done this successfully once, we can just duplicate this? What is the situation?
So we've made a request for a storage license or licenses over Knox and Lowry. Now, for the listeners, those fields have very similar geological attributes to Marram, and so they can be developed in a very similar way to Marram as energy storage facilities. And so we see those as expansion opportunities for energy pathways to add to the sort of core mesh project we've already described. Now, is there, let's say, demand for increased storage capacity? Look, in my mind, when you look at the UK having effectively one tenth of the storage capacity of countries like Germany and France and Italy and the Netherlands, the UK is, let's say, very, very poorly equipped, let's say, to deal with the energy transition from a storage capacity, and we see a lot of scope for expanding the UK's
Yeah,
storage
well,
capacity.
if we look at the thing now macro wise, and I want to ask you one question just before we look at the macro. What is the financial situation of EPP? How do you feel that is looking?
Yeah, well, I think the financial position of the company, as we've indicated in our RNSs previously, is that we think there's pools of capital for clean energy projects and companies that are out there, and we think that we're appealing to some of that financial capital, and we feel we're getting encouraging feedback. So we continue to look for low cost capital solutions for our shareholders, and we'll continue to do that. But as far as I can see, there is that pool of clean energy capital that is out there. We're increasingly appealing to that.
Yeah, it's more like a reservoir than a pool, I think. If you put the same analogy, there's a lot of cash wanting to go into green projects, and I don't think that's going to stop anytime soon. And I presume you've drawn down from your green loan facility, and cash flow wise, the company's in a good position.
Yeah, no, so we've drawn down on the green loan facility. That was a required drawdown under the agreement. So it's sort of de minimis amount. We've got sufficient financial capital at the moment. We're pleased with the green loan facility. We think it's a cost effective capital solution for the company. We're glad to have that in our armory. We're pressing on to get to our FID solution.
Yeah, which is ultimately the end game. By the end of 2025, you want to be in and around a financial investment decision, or final investment decision, which is then going to put you in a position to take these monies that you've talked about that are in different pools, and hopefully put them in place to produce the gas in 2027, and then be a storage facility thereafter, I presume. That's the game.
Look, indeed, and in that journey, as we go to FID, we'll also be looking for financial solutions for the actual development phase of work too, and we are, and again, we're encouraged by the feedback that we're getting, and so all of this needs to sort of come together as we approach FID. But ultimately, by being an infrastructure asset and a clean energy infrastructure asset, what we're developing, we're offering long-term yields for investors of equity and debt. And that sort of project, I think, also has a lot of attractive features for bringing in gearing into the development
Yeah.
project.
Pension companies are going to love you, I think, come down the line. I think there is no doubt. So looking at it macro, basically, the Conservative government obviously didn't help. The Labour government's not helping any further. In fact, maybe it's even worse. They've basically dropped a nuclear bomb on the UK's wish to produce its own oil and gas. So how does this impact energy pathways? How does it impact, the whole of the UK? I mean, we've heard rumors that Centrica want to close the Rough facility. I mean, how does this all play out? I mean, I don't know about you, but it does play into energy pathways, into their hands. But is it not sheer madness on a UK perspective?
Look, well, the direction does play into the energy pathways strategy, absolutely, and why we identified that this was a growth sector for the UK energy space, and it's really just materializing as we thought it would. But sometimes, let's say, until you get hit with it, you don't really realize it's upon you. And I think this winter has completely validated the energy pathways business model. The near miss on blackouts in the country, very high energy prices due to supply constraints in the UK energy supply chain is really just a manifestation of what is happening. It's been happening for decades, but the UK is crying out for storage for energy security, as well as actually just managing the price of energy into the consumer. If it's all real-time energy supply, which effectively it is, the consumer gets hit with the high prices of energy when it's needed, on tap, when the wind's not blowing. We've seen that this winter. Gas prices got to, circa 120 pence a therm. This is a long past the traditional days where UK gas prices were, 30 to 40 pence a therm. Structural change has happened, and it all follows through to the consumer paying very high energy bills. So storage has a big part to play here to moderate the impact of these pricing impacts on the consumer.
Just as a final question in terms of the financial situation of the two stages of the project. You've got the first stage of the project, which is bringing the gas out the ground, and then you've got the second stage of the project, which is using the hole, in my technical words, to store the hydrogen. What is the proportion? For instance, if the gas is worth several hundred million, how much is the storage worth? Based on your price of, £1 per therm, let's say, I don't know what the average it would be, but how much is the gas potentially worth, and how much is the storage worth in proportion, if you like?
In a proportionate sense, the storage revenues or value could be in the order of double that of the gas, the produced gas value.
Okay, so in other words, what we're going to be doing is we're going to be taking out the gas, and we're going to make very handsome profits on that gas, and then subsequently use that money to obviously do the storage, and then move on to the other two projects, which are going to be copycat versions of what we've got in Mesh. Is that a good summation?
Yeah, it is. One minor point of clarification. What we really are doing here is building the storage facility right from the word go. So the capital that goes into producing the gas is effectively reused to run the storage operation. So the value, the utility of that capital investment is not, it's transformed from being a 6-year production asset to a 25-year multi-use production and storage use.
So, excuse me for being stupid, but I take it then from your answer, you can start to pump the hydrogen in even before all the gases come out.
Before all the gas, we need to create some storage capacity before we start injecting for storage. And initially, it will actually be gas being stored in the reservoir, as opposed to hydrogen. But yes, we'll be able to start storage operations once we've created some storage capacity, and that can happen in what we think is a relatively short time frame, essentially 2 years after startup of production.
Okay, very good. And if investors listening to this, why would they want to invest in this sector of the market, and especially in energy pathways?
Because I think we've got an early mover advantage in what I think is self-evident now, following this winter, a fast-growing and high-value sector, which is energy storage. And energy pathways is as has that, let's call it first mover advantage, with potential to be a very high value, multi-billion dollar type sector.
Very good. Well, on that note, we'll say Ben Klubsey of Energy Pathways, thanks very much for appearing on the podcast.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
And Ben, make sure that you cook your Sunday roast with gas.
Will do.
So let's move on to our second guest this week. We're joined by Sean Day, Managing Director of Greatland Gold, to discuss the company's impressive December 2024 update following the completion of its acquisition of Telfer and Havieron. In just 27 days under Greatland's ownership, Telfer delivered 33,882 ounces of gold equivalent, surpassing the initial production forecast by 33%. With dual train processing operations resumed, significant stockpiles in place, and plans for extending Telfer's mine life well underway, the company is making remarkable strides. Combine this with progress on the Havieron feasibility study and a robust financial position, Greatland is firmly establishing itself as a major player in the gold copper sector. Sean, welcome back to the podcast.
Hey, thanks very much for having me, gentlemen. It's a pleasure to be on again.
Absolutely. Happy New Year to you. It's not too late for saying that, but how was Christmas and New Year in the Day household?
No, it was good, mate. I think any time in January we can still say Happy New Year. So all the best. And no, it's a great time of the year in Australia. It's combined with our summer holidays. So it's a big break, but a less big break for me in Greatland. We were hard at it, making sure we can bind Telfer and Havieron into this integration to make it one unit, which we enjoyed
Yeah, I
immensely.
mean, obviously, Sean, I think you'll agree this is an impressive start to operations at Telfer. Just walk us through progress and how the production has exceeded, obviously, both the monthly rates, but also presumably your expectations as well.
Yeah, look, it was great first month. Yeah, it was 27.3 days of Greatland ownership. And you've got to celebrate the wins. We're just really pleased to have done that. Having said that, we're measured. We outperformed, I think you said in your intro, by just on 33% compared to that Telfer mine plan that was in our admission document up in the UK. So, as you say, that's a great result. Having said that, we're measured about, we still expect it to kind of sit around that plan. We had some higher grade, but it's really nice to start off so well, and we're going to continue to, to see what we can do there. Now we've got the keys.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, one of the standout comments from yourself was on the RNS was, transforming overnight from an explorer and developer to the owner and operator of Australia's third largest gold copper processing operation is a substantial achievement and a credit to the hard work and quality of our team. Did you expect to be saying those words sort of 6 months ago? Let's say it again, Australia's third largest gold copper processing operation.
Well, I've expected to be saying those words for about 36 months, truth be said. This is the reason I joined Greatland. Rapt to have delivered it. This was the big opportunity, and the size of the prize is tremendous. And it's great to hear those words. It's great to say the words. Yeah, so look, we're pretty excited about what we've put together. There's no relax. There's lots of work still to be done to complete the integration, and then to really focus on what we can do to these mine plans, both in the open pit and the underground. And then, of course, the jewel in the crown is actually Havieron still. So I always expected to have the opportunity to do this. I may have put a higher probability on it happening than anyone else ever did, but yeah, this is what I joined Greatland to do.
Yeah, absolutely. That's because you're naturally optimistic anyway, and a positive force. So, I mean, let's look at the you did say that a more comprehensive assessment of cost metrics, including the all-in sustaining costs, will be reported for the full March 2025 quarter, along with the production and cost guidance. So, obviously, it's a short period, 27.3 days. So, really, I guess that's why you held back on any more cost metrics from being released thus far.
Yeah, look, it's 27 days. It's a really peculiar 27 days as well, not necessarily on production, but in terms of financing, because there's this disintegration or demerger out of Newmont. So look, there's a lot of creditors being reconciled between us and Newmont. So it's not really a representative 27 days. So we just felt we were better just to come out once we've got that more steady state quarter. And of course, in 27 days, minor variations can be accentuated as well. But again, you see that cash balance of 145 million, you see the ounce production. It was a good 27 days, but we just want to kind of keep people steady and focused on what we described in that ambition document, Telfer mine plan for now. And but to add to that, we'll come out with a very full and comprehensive quarterly. That's something you see commonly in Australia, so we want to start that now in London, and then you'll just see that quarterly cadence as we just kind of put out those consistent numbers.
Hi, Sean. So you basically produced 33,822 ounces of gold in those 27 days. Is that correct?
That includes the copper equivalent, but yes.
Okay, so that is your total package. And at $2,600 US gold, that's about $88 million in the month in terms of revenue.
Yeah, we didn't necessarily sell all that gold. I think we did announce our first gold sale. But again, because we were over that Christmas period, you're not necessarily doing an outturn to the Perth Mint on New Year's Eve.
No, it's not really whether you sell it or not, but I mean, if that guidance continues for the year, you are on track to do more than $1 billion worth of gold sales. Is that fair to say?
More than $1 billion. Yes, I think that's
You nearly
that
said
would.
absolutely. It'll be much more than that, didn't
I think I caught myself and said, look, the final revenue across 2025 will also be subject to what that gold price is over the next 12 months, but we're certainly off to a good start.
And that said, the gold has now moved up above $2,700, and all the analysts are saying they're expecting it to hit $3,000 this year at some point. Maybe it doesn't stay there, but I don't think we're over egging it. An average price of 2,600 would probably be potentially being conservative. Obviously, you never know in the gold market, but yeah. And also,
But the
the
other.
copper price there obviously is going to fluctuate as well, and that also has an impact on the money.
Both are good right now, but remember, we're also an Australian dollar producer. So our cost structure is in Australian dollars. And I think the Aussie dollar is currently trading about 62.5 cents. That's relatively low. So the Aussie dollar is a bit soft, but it means those US dollars are translating into more Australian dollar revenue. And when you think about that Australian revenue, our cost structure is largely, not exclusively, but largely just in Australian dollars. The low Aussie gold price, or sorry, the low Aussie exchange rate to the US, to the greenback, actually further helps our earnings outlook. So it's a good time to be a gold producer. It's a great time to be an Australian dollar gold producer.
And it's a great time to list on the Australian market in the next few months.
But we think that's a great way to augment the London listing. Yeah, we remain grateful and appreciative of the opportunity that London has provided for us, the support we got out of London to do this transaction. But there's no doubt, A, that Australians came into that equity raise heavily to support this transaction, and that there's a lot of Australian funds that are mandated for ASX listed that buy gold stocks. We think it gives us an entire new market to augment what we have with a cross listing, and we're certainly keen to get that up in the June quarter.
Very good. So, do you think this is just a bit of luck that you've managed to produce 33% above what the initial monthly mine plan was, or actually you're going to do this either on a regular basis or even exceed these figures? Obviously, you're not going to answer that question, but I'll give you a chance anyway.
Well, I think the team makes its own luck. The harder we work, the luckier we are. So yeah, I think this is it's Yeah, the most challenging period for us was that period immediately after transaction. We also turned on the second train. So remember, Telfer has two 10 million ton trains. We turned on that second 10 million ton train about 15 minutes after the transaction completed. So that's really challenging, turning on a second train in the processing plant. The team at Telfer hadn't done a lot of processing for the last 12 months, so that team like a football team are a little bit scratchy coming back onto the training track and then getting into their first game. So all of those challenges that we've been faced with, and we think we're getting that sight match fit. And the more we practice, the more effort we put into it, the more we prepare, we think the better the outcomes we can drive. And we're really excited about the opportunities there are at this site. But for now, we're happy kind of anchored around that Telfer mine plan in our admission document. But it's certainly nice to be ahead of the curve rather than under the curve after that first month.
Yeah, and that's a lot of staff, isn't it? I think there was the Telfer workforce was something like 435 employees. That's a lot of staff.
Yeah, it's that, and probably more than that in contractors as well. So, we've kind of gone from, kind of 15, 20 people at Greatland to 1,015 or 1,020. So it was a heck of a step. Myself and a number of the team has some pretty good integration experience on exactly this kind of thing, buying gold mines off majors in Australia. So we felt we had the requisite experience to tackle this. But it's, there's a lot of work and there's still a lot of work to be done. But we feel we've put in place a team that optimizes our opportunity of completing that successfully.
Yeah, and let's talk about the stockpiles as well, because they were mentioned in the RNS, the as of 31st of December. So we've got 10.9 million tons run of mine, containing 247,000 ounces of gold, 7,600 tons of copper, and then obviously the low grade as well. I mean, running numbers on that, just sort of like estimates, you're well over $1 billion worth of material there, Sean.
Absolutely. Now, that's subject to recovery, and there's obviously some cost to process that. So that's not cash in the bank. But this is, this is exceptional. I cannot think of another operation with, over 500,000 ounces at surface plus the copper. That is exceptional. And this is why it's the best time to own Telfer since 2005. You've got that high gold price that we've discussed. You've got these stockpiles at surface over in excess of 500,000 ounces. Plus, we've got Havieron coming online, into 27. So that's kind of on the horizon. We just think it's a cracking time to be at Telfer.
Yeah, and also just also add a bit of colour to that there was a mention of the Telfer extension. Obviously there's a site-wide mine plan extension target review, and then obviously a ranking exercise. Just talk us through a little bit of what that sort of entails.
Yeah, look, that's really important for us. We came out with that initial starting mine plan, but when we look in the open pit, there's the stage 8 extension and the stage 7. They're fully drilled. Look, we're putting them through the mine planning process now, but at this gold price, we think we're confident that they will likely fit into a Greatland mine plan at our cost structure. We look at the underground, that West Dome Deeps. We want to share that drilling with the market as we get some more assays back in. But that's a really high grade area. Now, there's a lot of work for that to hang together, but that's also exciting. So, there's these known opportunities at Telfer, both in the open pit and underground, and people should be confident that we're going to go and we're going to go and tackle that. We're going to spend time, energy, and effort to drill them out to the extent they haven't been drilled out, and to invest in the mine planning to make sure we can give these things every opportunity to come into the mine plan.
So, if 7 and 8 and this high grade underground area were to be incorporated, I mean, are we talking this would add months, or it is potentially years onto this mine plan? I mean, what sort of volumes are we talking about here?
Yeah, look, the volumes in that open pit are generally large volume. So it's not necessarily years, but it's not weeks or months. It's a year or more, but it's not decades.
It's not
But
10
that
years,
doesn't,
no.
yeah, but that doesn't mean we can't keep drilling and identify more and bring more opportunities in. Subject to success in the drill bit. The underground is more complex. You generally taking smaller volumes out of that underground. So even though they're much higher grade, what you tackle, what is often there, often if successful, and it hangs together in mining shapes, and the geotech and the hydrology all hangs together, and that's the work that needs to be done, and we shouldn't underestimate the challenges and the workload of the mine planning team. But if that hangs together, they're often quite long mine lives simply because you bring them out at a more measured rate. But when you've got really high grade, that can translate to a meaningful amount of tons as well. So, yeah, that's one of the things we're spoilt with at Telfer, is we have the confluence of this, you know, high grade underground at Telfer and at Havieron, but also the volume of the open pit.
So in terms of the open pit, when you said sort of, let's say 12 to 18 months, just to speculate, you're talking like 7 would be 12 to 18 months and then 8, a further 12 to 18 months or collectively?
Oh, look, when I'm talking about that, I'm probably talking combined for those structures. But again, we're still kind of putting the mine plan together on them. So this is, I think, was it more of an illustration as you described, but I wouldn't be kind of doubling at that at this stage. But then we look at going back into the main dome. There's a big cut back there. So, you know, there's multiple opportunities like this that we can work on. So, you know, we think there's a lot of work still to be done there.
So what would be your aspiration in terms of Telfer? I mean, initially in the plan and raising the money, it was for X period of time. What would be your aspiration to try and expand this? You know, is it to go to 8 years, 10 years, 12 years in terms of productivity?
Look, the way I might think about that is, look, we have this 20-year mine plan at Havieron. Havieron may take half or even, you know, three quarters of a mill of a train at Telfer. You know, that, if I can describe it as a treadmill, you know, right now, if Telfer finds 40 million tonnes, that's probably just a little bit more than 2 years of mine life. Let's say if you slow that treadmill down to 10 million tonnes that you need to find because the rest you're getting from other sources, say Havieron, well, then that same 40 million becomes 4 years, not two. So that's how I think about it. I think as we bring Havieron online, as we look at these other kind of regional opportunities, such as the Southeast Hub, which again is a delineated small open pit, but something that we'll probably go back and look to tackle, the cutback in the main dome, the cutbacks in the west dome. Yeah, if the more of these we can add, the more ore sources we can feed through this, just it slows down the lifting that any one area has to do. So that's how we think about it. And with a 20-year mine life at Havieron, and perhaps we want to accelerate that and get that through the mill quicker. But for as long as Havron's running, ideally you're filling the mill with and supplementing to fill the mill with that Telfer ore.
Okay, so we have a full, long horizon. You'd be fully filling the mill then for potentially the next 20 years. Is under that scenario?
Yeah, look, that's the aspiration. And of course, you've got two mills, so you can also look at just filling one mill. So there's multiple ways to do that, and there's multiple ways to think about the capacity of a single train rather than two trains. I think these are multifaceted equations that we'll be tackling over the course of, you know, a decade or two. But there's flexibility. You're far more flexible with two trains, or indeed twice as flexible than you are if you only have one train. So we like that about how the asset is configured.
Good. Yeah, and the other thing obviously I just want to touch on is, you know, investors and listeners would also be pleased to hear that the work on the Havieron feasibility study is progressing as planned, with completion targeted for the second half of 2025 as per the RNS. So that's good news.
Yeah, look, we've invested in that study team. This is our first opportunity to show what Greatland thinks Havieron is, and we've really spent 3 years preparing this, or even before that, the great work the geologist team did putting together the resource and then ultimately led to some of that being upgraded to reserve. We've spent a lot of time on this. We're now putting it together, you know, to feasibility study standard. And you know, I think that, you know, we're really excited about, you know, daylighting the way what we think Havieron can be while simultaneously having the benefit of production at Telfer.
So, Sean, I know you don't like these questions, but I'll ask them anyway. $1.1 billion US dollars is probably round about what your market cap is at the minute. And just doing the back of the fag packet calculations based on your first month, you're going to be producing maybe $500 million of free cash flow. Does that add up in terms of valuation?
Oh, well, I love questions like that, but I'm going to take it as a statement rather than a question.
I like that, yeah.
Okay, what should be the value show?
Oh, look, we don't comment on the value of the stock, and look, what I try to do is control what I can control. Look, we've consolidated ownership of Telfer and Havieron. We've, I think, demonstrated a really good start to the integration. We've demonstrated ounce production. We're in a good gold market. I just figure if we can deliver the next quarter and we can deliver the quarter after that and show that consistency, ultimately the share price will take care of itself. But equally, I'm impetuous and impatient to see that uplift.
Yeah, no, everything is everything. The stars are aligning, if you like, and I'm quite sure. You're not sitting on your laurels in terms of the ability for Greatland to expand in other ways and not just with Telfer and Havieron. So yeah, we look forward to watching the story because I think you're going to be a multi-£1 billion business going forward. It's only way that's not going to happen is if something drastic happens in the gold market, or alternatively, you drop the ball actually processing this stuff. So yeah, and we don't expect either really, but you never know, obviously.
Yeah, look, we're excited about the opportunity we've created for ourselves, and yeah, we understand the work of delivering that is ahead of us. But you know, great to give people that first cider, and great to have delivered for the first month. But one swallow a summer doesn't make. And we're aware that, you know, we build our reputation, we build our credibility, we build value for shareholders by showing that performance consistently.
It's great to hear. So on that note, we'll say Sean Day, MD of Greatland Gold. Thanks very much for appearing on the podcast.
It's always a pleasure. Really, appreciate your time as well. And always good to go through the questions.
Thanks, Sean.
So let's move on to our third and final guest this week. Joining us is Tim McCarthy, CEO of ImmuPharma, a biopharmaceutical company revolutionising healthcare with peptide-based therapies. ImmuPharma focuses on developing innovative treatments for autoimmunity, inflammation, and infections, with its lead clinical asset, P140, advancing in phase three trials for systemic lupus erythematosus, SLE, and pivotal phase two, three trials for chronic inflammatory demyelinating polyneuropathy. The company is also leveraging proprietary technology to enhance the properties of peptides and small molecules while creating value through strategic partnerships and robust pipeline. Tim, it's a pleasure to have you with us.
Yes, Phil, thank you very much. It's great to speak to you guys.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, obviously it sounds very complicated, some of these words on there,
I was
the
going to say,
SLE.
don't ask me to say any of those
No,
things, by the
you've
way,
no
Tim,
chance. I
because
mean, I've been
it's
practicing
not
for
going to
about
happen.
Been practicing for a week on all those. But so tell us, Tim, this lupus, the way I understand it, and you will correct me, is lupus is effectively a chronic autoimmune disease where the body's immune system effectively mistakenly attacks its own tissues, which can obviously lead to inflammation and damage in various organs, and obviously in some cases can be fatal, skin, joints, kidney, and heart. So what is it that, and how prevalent is this lupus or this autoimmune disease, not only in the UK but around the world?
Lots of very good questions there, Phil. Let me just try and let me say you made the introduction very well. Every single pronunciation of those words was spot on, so you must have been practicing. I must say I have to practice them sometimes as well because they're long words, aren't they? But and then that probably actually prompts me to sort of take this back to basics, and you asked a few questions there. When we're talking about autoimmune diseases are very prevalent across the world, and there are some disease indications that an awful lot of people don't even realize are autoimmune diseases. Yeah, so it covers a wide spectrum of diseases. So lupus, you mentioned, arthritis, some GI diseases, thyroid, lots of different diseases that people get through their lives are as a result of autoimmune disease. And what do I mean by that? So your immune system as most people will understand, is there to help protect you, to fight off viruses, to give you balance, in your body. And what happens is when somebody contracts an autoimmune disease, it does mean that the immune system mistakenly believes that it's under attack in one way or the other. So you might you have to forgive me, and your viewers forgive me, because I'm feeling a little bit flu-y and stuffed up today. So you can probably hear that in my voice. And so, my immune system is, as we speak, as I speak, it's fighting that infection off in a natural sort of way. And sometimes we're given help by taking flu jabs or COVID jabs or whatever else, and vaccines, actually, when we're youngsters, and even when we're a little bit older, to help us to fight off those diseases. And if I can explain it in that way, when you receive a vaccine, what that vaccine is doing is putting a tiny amount of the disease or the virus into your body to gear up your immune system to start producing antibodies. And when it starts to produce antibodies, it then gets protection, from that particular virus or whatever, for that particular point in time and for the future. And you'll know from your own experience that some vaccines will last, for a period of time, some will last, for your whole life. It just depends on how they work. When you get an autoimmune disease, the immune system, in a sense, responds in a similar way. It believes it's under attack, so it starts to produce a response, but there isn't actually anything that it's under attack from. And instead of producing antibodies, it produces what we call autoantibodies. And depending on the person or the patient concerned, those autoantibodies will have an impact on that person to produce or initiate, if you like, if that's the right word, a disease state. So, as an example, very personal example, I have an underactive thyroid. And I contracted this in my early 40s. This is an autoimmune disease. There was no indication of it, before that. I just suddenly started feeling unwell and tired and lots of different symptoms. So over a period of time, and actually this is something I'll come back to in a moment because it's very relevant to what we've just put out a couple of weeks ago in the preclinical research we've done with ImmuPharma. But it took a while for my condition to be properly diagnosed. But when it was decided it was an underactive thyroid, a particular condition called Hashimoto's disease. And so every day now I take some replacement thyroxine, and I go up and down a little bit, but generally I'm fairly stable. But that was the impact on me, because my immune system went at what we call out of balance. And it will affect somebody else in a different way. And certainly in the lead indication that ImmuPharma has with lupus, and back to your point, we're talking about tens of millions of patients across the world that suffer from lupus. And it depends on the genetic makeup of the person. There tends to be more women than men, for example, that suffer from lupus. We tend to see it in certain genetic types in more prevalence than others, but it's around across the world, without any distinction. And so it's a condition which unfortunately has not been, to date. There are a couple of drugs on the market to try and help patients, but there's nothing that deals with everything. To give patients very good efficacy, to reduce or even eliminate, their symptoms. And, you always, with any drug, you have to be careful that the benefit exceeds the risk, if I can put it that way. The risk benefit in pharmaceuticals. And that, again, I'll come back to, but that's what we're presenting with ImmuPharma's drug, P140. But just coming back to the basic explanation which you asked for. So depending on how that autoantibody reacts with the immune system of the person concerned, they will present with a different autoimmune disease or not. And that's essentially the way that I can, describe it, really, to be honest to you, Phil. I hope that helps in terms of a non-scientific explanation.
So here you are with this, as you said, this sort of lead clinical asset P140. Just talk us through, in layman's terms, if possible, how this is differentiated from other products. I mean, how many other products are there on the market, or that are in sort of phase 3 trials for autoimmune diseases? And also, I believe it's something called a peptide-based therapy. How is that? What does that actually mean in terms of the therapy there?
A number of things there are quite important. So, firstly, that unfortunately for patients, there aren't that many approved drugs for lupus, and so an awful lot of patients, the majority of patients rely on what we call standard of care, which will be something like steroids. And those steroids are designed to try and reduce the effect in your immune system. But unfortunately, as you will appreciate, steroids, especially taken long term, have their difficult side effects. In terms of drugs being developed, there's an awful lot of research and development going on in this area for the right reasons, because the industry is trying to find solutions for patients, because it's an awful disease. It really is a debilitating disease. And what we find, and the differential that we have with P140, is the other approaches to try to treat lupus and in development all have a similar approach, where they have a certain drug profile. Monoclonal antibodies are very prevalent in this area. And what they're trying to do is to, if I can put it in this way, restrict the immune system. In other words, they're saying, well, the immune system has gone out of balance. If we can stop that happening, if we can stop that physiological impact from the immune system producing all these autoantibodies, and in this case, producing the lupus in patients, then that will help. I will stop the lupus happening. We're talking about lupus here, but I mean, for P140, we're talking about any autoimmune disease. Unfortunately, what that does is it does restrict your immune system. And as soon as you start restricting your immune system, then you're opening yourself up to all sorts of infections and side effects, etc. And also, it's very difficult to, if you like, put your hands on everything. Your immune system is not, in a sense, one organ, like your heart or your kidneys or something. It's all over your body, and it's virtually impossible to say we are going to stop the impact on the immune system. So that's why the efficacy of a lot of these drugs is not 100%, because you can't close down your immune system completely. And even if you did, you'd have all the serious side effects, and they're getting those side effects, unfortunately, because they're closing down the immune system. So the drugs in development, there is no other similar approach than what we have in ImmuPharma. And that's why we're using words such as groundbreaking and innovative when we're talking about P140. And we did in the news release we put out on the 9th of January a couple of weeks ago. And that's all coming back. That's coming as a direct result of the preclinical research and data that we produced in the second half of last year, which I'll come back to and explain in a moment. But to put it in context, and this is important from ImmuPharma's point of view, we are the only company, and believe me, we've done our research, we know what's going on in the industry. We are the only company that are offering the opportunity with P140 for a whole, what we call, platform of being able to treat all autoimmune diseases without any side effects. And we've got a certain amount of clinical data on that already, preclinical data to support that. And the data that we announced on the 9th of January really is the last piece of the jigsaw to prove, if you like, our hypothesis. And our hypothesis is very simple. The way that P140 works on the immune system, it gets it back in balance. It's not trying to strangle it or stop the immune system from working. It brings it back into balance. And that's what I was saying earlier about somebody suffering from an autoimmune disease. It's because their immune system, for various reasons, biological reasons, has gone out of balance. So it's a little bit like getting on a two-wheeled bicycle and you're riding down the road and you're feeling fine, and you're even getting to the point where you can take your hands off the handlebars and you're feeling fantastic. And all of a sudden you start to get a wobble. Yeah. And you're wobbling backwards and forwards, and you're trying to correct it. And what P140 is doing is giving the person on that bike the ability to rebalance themselves. The bike comes up straight again. You haven't restricted the ability for that bicycle to move forward and the wheels to go around. So everything's fantastic, and you're back in balance again. And that's what. And then there are no side effects. You're back to where you started. And that's what P140 is intended to do. The difference between our peptide approach and the other approaches is important also, because P140, as you say, is a peptide-based drug, which means it's very simple to manufacture, very inexpensive to manufacture, and that, in terms of the overall economics, makes it a lot easier. And it's a lot easier for the patient to take, because It's administered through what was called a subcutaneous injection, so a little jab in the top of your arm or somewhere, a little bit like it when you take a vaccine. Whereas a lot of the other drugs have to be infused over a period of time. So that means the patient needs to go into a hospital or a care centre somewhere, probably sit there for an hour or two, depending on the drug concerned. So there are lots of advantages from a biological perspective, lots of advantages from a commercial perspective. Because anyone who is marketing this drug on our behalf, because we won't be marketing it direct, somebody else will be marketing it. There are lots of opportunities for them to be able to deliver this drug to patients that have been waiting for a long time. But on the commercial side, there are lots and lots of advantages that P140 will have as well.
So Tim, in the RNS that you put out a few weeks ago before you went off to the conferences in America, you were a bit you were hiding the details, okay? Because you couldn't give those details out. So we're looking for an exclusive. What are these details that are going to make everybody go, "Ooh, we want this"? And I presume you were able to share those details with the people when you went over to America. So did they go, "Ooh"? I know that's not a very technical question, Tim,
Kevin,
but
I know you're trying to keep tease me out with some things, but I'm going to say straight up, I'm not going to give you any details. But it's
okay.
important I explain why. Because what we announced on the 9th of January, and the timing of that was important as well, because it was immediately before we went to San Francisco to the JPM Morgan conference and the Allied sort of or alongside Biotech Showcase. Those two conferences are the premier conferences in the year for companies in our industry, small, medium, large, to get together, have the opportunity over a week in one place where you can get together and talk and see whether there's anything you can do together. We put the announcement out on the 9th of January, the week before the conference, so that we had this new data that we could talk about and we could pick up discussions that we're already in the back end of last year with a lot of major pharma companies on P140. And I'll come back to that in a moment. But it allowed us to have a little bit more detailed discussions with some of these companies when we were in San Francisco to a certain extent. And this goes back to your point about, am I going to give you lots of details? You're absolutely spot on. And I think we alluded to it in the RNS that there's only so much that we can put in the RNS because this is new data, it's new findings. And in our world, intellectual property and patents are the key. Yeah. So we will be at some point this year submitting new patents and we are constantly generating new intellectual property around these findings, which will mean we'll give a whole new commercial life to P140 in the marketplace. Because the way that these drugs are marketed, the reason that pharmaceutical companies spend literally billions in research is that one, the drugs they sell billions, yeah, but they sell them under the guise that they have exclusivity for a certain period of time before other companies can come in and start selling generic versions of them. And that's all protected through patents. Yeah. And if you don't have those patents, then there's not an awful lot of commercial incentive to people spend billions of dollars getting it to market and then somebody comes along and just puts a similar or generic next to it. So it's important for us that we do have good patent protection already on P140, but if we can, based on the results of these studies we've just done, we can put new patents in and generate new intellectual property, then that will give us and our partners in the future a whole new 20 years of commercial protection. And that is extremely valuable from a commercial perspective. Extremely.
So one of the things I took from it was that you were obviously aiming at the autoimmune sector, but in terms of it, the P140 was very specific for lupus. But you seem that has changed, like the horizon has broadened. Is that a fair take on it or not?
Yes and no, in the sense that, and so just to finish off the last point, Kevin, sorry, that's the reason we didn't put the data and the details in the RNS, and the reason that I can't talk about it today, because as you'll appreciate, you can't patent something which is already in the public domain. Yeah. So we need to make sure that we've protected that through patent applications, everything else, and we're working very closely with our patent agents on this. So unfortunately, it's not because we'd love to be able to tell you all the detail, but for obvious reasons we can't. Yeah. However, under CDA, I'm sorry, that what I mean by that's confidential disclosure agreements, or in other words, when you go into discussions with pharmaceutical companies on potential partnerships or collaborations, this is all usually done under confidentiality. And under confidentiality with companies that we're speaking to, we can talk about some of these details. Yeah. So that is the way that you can address this. But I can't discuss it publicly for the reasons I said. So some of the companies we're talking to were under CDA already. Some we're intending to get under CDA in the very near future. And that will allow us then to demonstrate to these companies what we do have. And coming back to your point, we have always believed and have the hypothesis that P140 will be applicable across all autoimmune disease. Yeah. And it's what we call in the industry a technology platform. So you develop the platform which will have utility across a number of disease indications, in this case, autoimmune disease. Yeah. Now you have to prove that. And you know, we've done lots of things over the last year or two to emphasize that. We've done a lot of work in the last eight, well, sort of year really, on what we call MOA or mechanism of action. How exactly does our drug work on the immune system? Yeah. And we've talked about that in press releases and things last year. That the work that we did the back end of last year, second half of last year, which we announced on 9th of January, was very key because there are a few reasons for us doing it. One, we wanted the absolute definitive proof. I think I said earlier that the last piece of the jigsaw to prove our hypothesis. Yeah. And what that data has produced is exactly that. So it's given us even more confidence in our hypothesis and what we're presenting, both to ourselves and our belief, but also what we're now, you know, quite intimately talking to with big pharma companies and potential partners for, you know, for the future. And as I said, in addition, that data will allow us to submit new patents, which is, you know, clearly very important. But our belief has always been that this technology will allow us to treat all autoimmune diseases in a safe way, you know, without the side effects. And this is all just part of the, you know, the building up of data, building up of proof. And, you know, one, it's important not that we can also get pharma companies to come along and partner with us and take this to market, but it's important for physicians in the future. It's important for patients in the future to understand the drug is different. And it is very, very different. I have to say, it's unique within the industry, and that's why we're getting, you know, an awful lot of interest in this. The other thing that came out of the work we were doing and we announced on the 9th of January was this whole, what I would call the diagnostic part of this. Because I alluded earlier to when I first got my thyroid problem, you know, it took quite a while for the doctors and the different physicians that I saw to actually diagnose me properly and get me the right treatment. And one of the other things that has come out of what the work that we did was the ability now to be able to identify earlier and give more accurate diagnoses of autoimmune diseases. At the moment, there is no diagnostic tool for identifying autoimmune diseases. You know, it's very much a situation where a patient is feeling unwell, they go to the doctor or physician and they try and say, well, I'm feeling like this and this is my symptoms. And, you know, the general practitioner or the primary care provider is trying to work out, right, what is wrong with you? Now, remember, we're looking at this in the lens, you know, coming backwards. We're talking about autoimmune diseases. When that patient first goes to the doctor, the patient or the doctor don't necessarily know that they're suffering from autoimmune disease. They're just unwell and they're presenting symptoms. Yeah. So it's not at the moment, it's not like, well, let's run some bloods and let's see how all your levels are and we'll be able to see whether you're inflamed or you've got, you know, some of your things are out of line. And then that guides the doctor to be able to say, well, I think, you know, you may be suffering from this and this is how we can treat you. That's not possible with autoimmune disease at the moment. What the work we have done last year and what we announced on the 9th of January will allow us to be doing that in the future. So what we're not only saying that we're proving how P140 works on the immune system and then using P140 to treat patients, we're also saying we're developing the ability to be able to diagnose autoimmune diseases where you can't really do that at the moment. And that's a really, really important part of all of this. And then following on from that, if we've identified the autoimmune disease, we've identified those patients, we can also see whether they will respond to P140. And if they do and they go on the treatment, then we can monitor them through the same techniques. Really, really big step forward.
So how big a deal is it that you can run these tests to find out about the autoimmune disease as opposed to the drug? Is it sort of maybe even bigger than a drug itself, or is it going to just be a small compartment of the whole deal?
No, I mean the diagnostic part of it is I'm not going to I'm not I wouldn't say in commercial terms it's as big as selling the drug itself, but it's linked in the sense that if you can identify in patients those patients that are suffering from autoimmune disease and try and define that will allow the patients to get treatment sooner and more relevant treatment to them, to what they're suffering from. So that in itself will drive the sales and the commercial side of this. Clearly, if you can't identify what a patient is suffering from, you don't know what treatment to give them.
Absolutely.
But the diagnostics in themselves, from a commercial perspective, clearly have a value, a big value, But when I'm comparing selling of the drug, which is going to go into potentially tens of billions of sales per year, even if you say it's a $1 billion market for the diagnostics, it's still a big market, but in comparison, they're not the same. They're not the same at all.
No. Don't worry about that $1 billion. We don't want that.
But there are some companies out there that this is very attractive to, because they see that you get it from start to finish, and they can help the doctors to identify the problems with the patient.
No, the
And if
addressable
they can do
market is going
that,
to be
then
bigger, isn't it? For sure.
no, absolutely. You drive the market. You absolutely drive the market from the bottom up.
I know you're suffering from a cold at the minute, so we're not going to go long, 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 because I want to do a long form interview with you in the next couple of weeks about all the technical parts. But just give people an idea what's going to happen, or what do you hope is going to happen in 2025?
So 2025, I'd like to use a term to say this is the year of delivery. And the reason I'm saying that, and if we do a longer term interview in the future, Kevin, I can probably go into a little bit more detail. Maybe and get, one of my te more technical guys on an interview with you as well. I think that would help without getting, too biotechy about it and all those
Yeah, no,
long
I think
words.
that would be really good. I think
Yeah,
it
no,
would.
we can certainly do that. But because I haven't spoken to you about this before, this is the first interview. You don't. I haven't talked to you about the history of Emi Pharma and the fact that I took over as CEO about 3 years ago, and it was a big change around in the management of the company. And from that point, with a completely new team, we've done an awful lot of work in the background to bring on the whole P140 platform, to expand the portfolio, and done an awful lot of work in the background, not always seen, by the public. And we're starting to come to the culmination of all of that. And we talked about P140 particularly. We're in lots and lots of discussions with pharma companies about taking P140 on and taking it to market, which, be absolutely fantastic for lots of reasons. But we also got other things in the portfolio as well, which don't have such a high profile in the public consciousness with Emi Pharma. And there's other discussions and other developments going on with those as well. So I would very much expect that this year 2025 will be one, a lot of business development activity, a few deals done. From the point of view of Emi Pharma, that means that we will have the support of those companies going forward to make sure our drugs get to market. In return, I would expect to be getting, some pretty substantial monies into the company in terms of license deals and that sort of thing, which in turn will allow us to put, more reinvestment back into some of the other drugs in the portfolio we have. So the thing then gets a virtuous circle. And, as with all biotech companies, development companies, Emi Pharma has had to go through, lots and lots of rounds of funding and struggling for money at times in order to keep the developments going. The sort of deals that we're expecting to do this year will certainly make us completely independent of, being able to, having to raise funding. We'll have a lot of spare resources, financial resources, to put back into, as I say, the other developments that we have in the company, which again it all goes to increasing value for shareholders. And then you, as you say, you get into this virtuous circle, as I call it.
Very good. Well, it's been great having you on, obviously talking through these breakthrough findings into autoimmune disease at a time when it's gaining a lot of traction in the press. So we just want to say, Tim McCarthy, CEO of Immu Pharma, thanks very much for appearing on the podcast.
Problem. Nice to see you guys.
Okay, so let's have a look at some of the movers and shakers of this week. At the time of recording, we had EXR, Engage XR Holdings, up some 130% on the week. We had Imperium Energy up some circa 50% after successfully completing the acquisition of an option to participate in a conventional oil exploration project in the Wilson River prospect in Australia. Incantera were up 40% on some nice buying. Let's hope that that one comes back this year after, you know, the legal wranglings that we've seen. Shakers, Mila Resources down 56% and Katanai down 40%. I mean,
What happened to Mila Resource?
yeah, Mila Resources had an update in the week on Wednesday, the Kathleen Valley update, and it was a termination notice. It was their Liontown Resources, which has been basically their subsidiary, announced a termination notice with regard to the option agreement with Trans-Pacific Energy Limited. So obviously Liontown will now not be seeking an exercise its option to acquire the stage one interest, which I think entailed an acquisition of 50% of the lithium rights for consideration of 200,000. So I guess Mila are now going to have to continue to evaluate the information provided by Liontown collected over the option, which there were some, you know, promising lithium and tantalum grades in the grab samples, but nobody likes that news, obviously, and termination of the option agreement. Any other news, Kev, this week that sort of stood out for you? I mean, obviously, we saw a bizarre one. We saw Priority Intelligence down 15%, which was a bizarre one, on obviously on some good news in the week when they announced an important partnership with the Funding Circle, one of the UK's leading providers of small business loans and finance. The collaboration will significantly enhance Priority's offering and expand its footprint within the small to medium enterprise SME technology landscape by enabling Priority's customers to access alternative debt financing options seamlessly via the Priority platform. So I think this allowed customers to access loans of up to 750,000, obviously subject to the lending criteria, within minutes. What did you make of that news?
I think it's very good news. Both Dan Gee. G and James are historically been raisers of cash for businesses, so this gives them an option to do it seamlessly and without equity dilution. If some of the companies that are going to be signing up or have already signed up to Priority AI want cash, I'm looking at it saying, can they lend 5 to 10 million pounds a year? And I think the answer is probably yes. And if that would be the case, then they will more than cover their overheads, I think, just on a on a kickback, if you like, from those loans. Plus, I think it, people would ask, do anybody can go and do this in Funding Circle? They can, but if you're in the Priority AI system and all you then have to do is click a button. And get approval, because all the information is already in the Priority AI artificial intelligence model that you're using, then obviously it's going to be good, and it's good for Funding Circle as well, because probably no admin, it's like straight through to their situation. So yeah, I think the market's misread it, but I think it's very early days. I think basically it's been sold down because a few of the Alteration Earth people wanted out. That's why it's down over 50% from when it listed. It's very disappointing, but I think if you look at what they've actually got and what they're going to have going forward, I think it's a very sound investment. And if you got the opportunity to go in now at sort of 6p or thereabouts, as opposed to 13 in the IPO, then I think you're getting a hell of a deal.
Absolutely. The other one that stood out, and you alluded to it at the top of the show, was obviously Guardian Metal Resources, that they welcome the Unleashing American Energy executive order signed by President Donald Trump. The policy prioritized domestic energy and critical minerals, directly supporting Guardian Metal's mission to develop tungsten, a key defense and industrial metal, at its Pilot Mountain project. So obviously the key provisions of the order include faster permitting process, so that's going to be, you know, pushed through, and we know it will be pushed through. You know, Trump does like to get things done. There's one thing about about him that you can't say he just sits on the sideline. So enhanced regulatory clarity, potential federal funding and strengthened support for critical minerals like tungsten to bolster the US national security and supply chain. CEO Oliver Friesen emphasized the alignment of Guardian Metals goals with the executive order's focus on reducing reliance on foreign minerals. So great news for that one. The other one was BSF Enterprise. They had a very good RNS in the week through the subsidiary 3D Biotissues. They partnered with global bioprocess leader Sartorius to advance sustainable and cost-effective biotech solutions. The collaboration, formalized through a memorandum of understanding, focuses on scaling production efficiency and sustainability for lab-grown leather and alternative protein products. So again, it's been described as a game changer for achieving cost-effective, sustainable production. And Sartorius's Dr. Erica Schulz emphasized their shared commitment to sustainability and innovation. Yeah, again, what did you make of that collaboration MOU?
Well, don't even want to try and pronounce it, but Sartorius or whatever they're called, they're a multi-billion pound company. They get the City Mix and the City Mix Plus into a few of the consumers that they use. And the revenue this is going to generate for BSFA is going to take it off the charts, if you like. And obviously, we've also got the development of leather and then producing the leather. But to understand, this is the City Mix. This is the product that is used to help the growth of the cells increase at a faster rate, so you can grow these things faster. And I think people didn't quite get it, but this could really be a money maker, and like just time after time after time after time money. It's not a one-time sale. It's like, as production for the leather increases, this is going to increase the scale of what BSFA or 3D Biotissue are going to have in this situation. So yeah, it is a game changer, and from such a low level as well in terms of the share price. Don't forget, this year when we were in the bit of the meat craze was over 20 odd p. And here you are, you can buy it for 3 and a bit p now, I think. So I think there's more to come. They've asked for an interview for some stage, I think next week. So watch this space.
Okay. Another one this week was Technology Minerals. They announced that its 48.35% owned recycling subsidiary, Recyclers Group, had successfully completed the recycling of fire-damaged lithium-ion battery packs from an electric vehicle OEM. The project involved dismantling and processing compromised battery packs at the Recyclers' Wolverhampton facility, showcasing its cradle-to-cradle recycling solution. This marks Recyclers' third major customer this month, including two automotive giants and an online retailer, demonstrating the capability to address the challenge of safely managing and recycling end-of-life or compromised lithium-ion batteries. Chairman Robin Brundle highlighted the growing demand for Recyclers' innovative solutions, emphasizing its role in supporting the transition to electrification by increasing the supply of critical metals. So good to see another deal there announced. Obviously, this is something there's a big problem there. Fire-damaged lithium-ion battery packs. We've obviously seen the issues in the past with any sort of damage to, whether it be damaged, ones that have been involved in a car collision there. We're seeing customers writing off cars because of potential issues with the batteries. But now fire damaged lithium-ion batteries that have been part damaged are now being able to be recycled. Brilliant news. What did you make of that? And what did the market make of it, more to the point?
The market liked it, I think, but the fact of the matter is that the share valuation on this company is 2.5 million pounds, I think it is, or 3 million pounds. So it is currently priced to fail. Of this, there is no doubt. It's obviously had its issues. It's had to issue a lot more stock as well to get it through. But I think the real key here is, and I think people will start to get this over the next few weeks, because it is weeks now, that the critical metal shares that they own in the US currently worth enough to probably wipe out most, if not all, of their debt. And then TM1 is still owed a significant amount of money then from Recyclers Group, i.e. 7 to it, I think it's 8 or 9 million pounds. So you are looking at that and saying, how can Teck Minerals itself be worth 3 million when it owns that proportion
Not factored in
40,
it. It's not even factored in
it's
any of
not
that.
factored in. None of it is factored in. So it's been at risk, and therefore people are like, "Ooh, shall I take this gamble?" The fact of the matter is, I think if the debt's paid off, they've still got quite a few assets. They've got a Spanish asset, they've got the Wolverhampton lead acid battery plant to be discussed as well. What's going to happen with that? It obviously has an intrinsic value. So there are enough assets within the company that how it's worth what it is seems a bit ridiculous, to be honest. But it is what it is. It's gone through a bit of a nightmare. And I think if anybody's brave at this stage, I think you could make several times your money over the next year for sure. Because if it starts working and recyclers starts becoming cash flow even neutral and then starts to become cash flow positive, then it's going to be plowing money back into increasing itself and then subsequently increasing Tech
Sure.
Minerals as well. And that's even without the plan of building maybe another plant, which was always on the cards, but they had to get through this financial situation.
Sure.
And I think they're like coming out of the tunnel. That's the way it looks to me. So yeah, let's
Yeah,
see.
okay. So let's have a look at the wider economy. I mean, obviously, the UK's economy is facing market turmoil with the cost of government borrowing climbing to near 30-year highs. The pound, as we said last week, weakened against the dollar, hitting a 14-month low. Situation has been highlighted as Chancellor Rachel Reeves returns from a trip to China. We've seen the FTSE 100, obviously, recently hitting a record high with the index exceeding 8,500 points for the first time. Obviously, several factors there on interest rate expectations, currency impact, economic data. But this composition, there's a big weighting in the FTSE 100 there, in the likes of oil and copper, which has obviously played a significant role on those higher commodity prices, which has pushed up the values of those, impacted the companies in these sectors. What do you make? I mean, the S&P is an interesting one as well. We've obviously saw that one bust through, hit an all-time high, closing at 6,118 on the January the 22nd, which is obviously, big market sentiment, investor confidence still in the US.
Yeah,
Record
it's
high recent.
sentiment. The sentiment is gonna keep pushing them, I'm pretty sure,
Yeah.
for a period of time.
I think the
Hopefully
other thing is
there's
that
been
there's been a
peace in
lot of.
Gaza. Will there be peace in Ukraine? I mean, if you look at it from an infrastructure point of view, if there's peace in Ukraine and there's peace in Gaza and we actually have to have those infrastructures rebuilt, what's that gonna do to commodities in the world? They have spent over a year literally destroying these areas.
Somebody up, they said that there's something like 25 Wembleys worth of concrete that needs moving from Gaza alone. Now, think about how big Wembley is. Filling that with concrete, that's how much has been devastated.
Yeah, no, it's
It's
been absolutely devastated.
absolute
And at the
devastating.
same time, we're obviously still in a people are nervous situation because gold is moving up. Is that really because effectively the dollar should be being depreciated? The pound has actually bounced back a bit from the dollar now. It's 124 as we speak, where it had gone
It
down
has, yeah.
to 122 or thereabouts. So, there is signs that the US con or the UK economy, sorry, is sort of starting to be resilient. I fully expect gold is going to hit 3,000, and I expect silver to be much better. I think silver's
I'd
going
like
to
to
go
see.
into the 40s, maybe even $50 silver we'll see this year. I mean, that's a big call, but I really do think that we've got that. And you look at stocks that could benefit from that, and the copper stocks that we talked about, like Bisant in is going to be that. Also, the Rio have got a massive project in the US, which they expect now maybe to get stamped, which has been delayed for 12 years. And that brings us back to Guardian Metal Resources as well. They are the only tungsten play in the US. And effectively, it could be worth a tremendous amount of money. You've got the garnets, you've got the tungsten, you've got the silver. So next week we've got Tempayu coming out. There's got to be a result really there to say yes, they're going to go ahead with that. And I fully expect then that Oliver will go for a grant on that as well. So, there is an opportunity then for them to get federal funding in two different way in two different projects. Let's hope the other one comes to fruition in the not too distant future. But share price is creeping up now, and fully expected to test next week. Probably it's all-time highs of I think it was 38 or 39p. And yeah, the sky's the limit with that one. I saw somebody write on one of the groups that potentially got a £500 million valuation. Now that might be over egging it a bit, but it's got a long way to go. So don't think you've missed the boat on Guardian Metal Resources, because I don't think you have missed the boat at all. I think it's got quite a few returns left in it.
And the other one I've got to mention, and this just very briefly, is Sovereign Metals in the week had a great RNS out, which we do need to mention. And obviously, what I would say is, rather than us saying anything more about it, you should listen to the midweek takeaway that Charles Archer interviewed Sapangai on the news of the optimized pre-feasibility study that was effectively run by in conjunction with Rio Tinto, using their technical expertise. Some slight changes to the numbers there from the original PFS, but again, we'll let him do all the talking. So have a look on the link. We'll put the link in this description to that interview with Charles, and Sapangai, CCO of Sovereign Metals. But on that note, I think we've talked long enough. Three great guests on this week, a triple header for you. If you like what you've heard, please do subscribe, hit the bell icon for any further notifications of any future episodes, and we'll just say thanks for listening and have a great weekend.
Yeah, thanks for listening, guys. Speak next week.
This podcast was brought to you by Roast PR Limited. If you would like to appear on a future episode of The Sunday Roast, please email admin@thesundayroast.net.